Michael Cowell, former hedge fund manager, commodities trader, private family office investor, and also the author of Cowboy Musings on Substack, and now, I guess, accidental software entrepreneur, which we'll get to later.
Right.
Welcome to Cowboy Investor. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Oh, thanks for having me, and congrats on your own show. This is great. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, Michael, I guess this is the first time we've spoken on my show here. And I always look forward to speaking with you because you put so much time and diligence into your research, and today is no exception to that. You know, you recently put out a piece explaining how we're currently walking a tightrope between wildly divergent macro outcomes, between a stagflationary / reflationary type scenario, and the other being a very Goldilocks type scenario with disinflationary growth. So why don't we start by just defining the terms of each scenario?
Yeah. So let me just set the context real quick, because I refer to, my accidental software entrepreneurship is around, most of you probably know, is this a project called Urban Cowberg I've been working on, right? It's a financial terminal. And on it, I've got this feature called macro regime, where it kind of splits up the macro economy into kind of four quadrants, four sectors. If you imagine the x-axis measuring growth momentum, economic growth momentum, the y-axis measuring inflation momentum. So in the top right-hand corner, you've got high growth, high inflation. So we'll just call that like a reflation, inflationary environment. The top left-hand corner, we've got, you know, slow growth or negative growth, but high inflation. That's stagflation. Lower left-hand corner is low growth, low inflation. And we'll just call that deflation. Okay. And then the bottom right-hand corner is strong growth and low inflation, which is sort of like the magical Goldilocks disinflationary nirvana that we all want and we saw in the mid-90s. Okay. And my base case for this Trump 2.0 playbook, if you'll rewind the clock, bear with me, and rewind the clock over like a year now, right? I was a pretty lone contrarian voice amidst the sort of tariff chaos. You know, you remember like all of the stories back then where, you know, the Trump playbook was going to be massively, you know, inflationary, you know, with the tariffs, et cetera. And I said, you know, I don't think so. I think that this whole notion of bundling economic statecraft with a lot of these tariffs, what was happening was, you know, these tariffs were really meant to be like a demand redirection, demand destructive tool, mm-hmm. were not ultimately going to pass through a ton of consumer facing inflation. But what the bundling with these reshoring initiatives and reshoring commitments accomplished was I dubbed this term a reverse Marshall Plan. You got a ton of countries and companies to reinvest in America, right? And so for a while, you know, there seemed to be a little bit of tariff inflation. But if you looked at the macroeconomics in my piece Into the Void that you cited, from a couple of weeks ago, I basically showed the charts how, you know, last springtime, we were definitely in that Goldilocks period. Mm-hmm. We were seeing inflation start to trend down. You know, CPI, I'm looking at the chart here, like as of, for instance, September of 25, you know, CPI was trending above 3%. And, you know, by February of 2026, it had trended all the way down to 2.4, which was a local minimum. You know, GDP was inflecting back up, you know, and then if you looked at what happened subsequently over the next several months, you saw the one part of the equation that was still sort of like lagging, which was the economic growth part, you saw that all start to inflect up. And in my post, I pointed out GDP, ISM manufacturing, industrial production, a whole bunch of metrics, right? So my thesis was that, you know, if we could actually get into this period of especially AI-driven, productivity-led disinflationary growth, that coupled with some of the tariff revenues, but mainly because of this reverse Marshall Plan effect, you could easily see the overall deficit coming down, just like it did in the mid-90s, and debt to GDP go substantially lower. Notably, when the Big Beautiful Bill passed, one of the big criticisms of it came from the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO that basically said that, they were predicting as a result of the BBB, you're going to see, debt to GDP go from 120% to, 150% in 10 years or something. But then if you looked at what their embedded assumptions were, they were assuming a trough level of productivity growth, not seen. They assumed a trough level of productivity growth, which is 1.2% from the period of 1973 all the way to the mid 90s. And it seemed like they arbitrarily picked like the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. But if you looked at what actually happened in the mid 90s, where productivity went from like productivity growth went from like 2.5 to 3.5 to like 5%, it massively dropped debt to GDP because we grew our way out of it. And we had these secular deflationary or disinflationary forces that allowed us to grow out of our deficit effectively. And debt to GDP went way down. We actually achieved budget surplus during the Clinton years, if you remember that, right? So I still see that as a potential path because the secular setup for the most part hasn't changed. We've had this AI-driven, productivity-driven led revolution. There's been a lot of deregulation on from the administration side to help that along, and there's also been these growth initiatives, these reshoring initiatives that have been, as you'll see a little bit later, those have primarily been the struts holding up and bolstering this economy, right? But as I pointed out in my post, the big wild card here was this Iran war, which started on February 28th, because I think it certainly wasn't on my bingo card that this was going to happen or that it would have, or that the Strait of Hormuz would have stayed shut for this long, right? And I'm willing to bet that it wasn't on the administration's bingo card or the rest of the world's bingo card either, because the amount of disruption is pretty extraordinary. And, you look at what's happened to the yield curve, global yield curves before and after. You look at what's happened to the oil markets before and after. And now, if you go to Urban Kalberg's macro regime, you're seeing that we've moved from that disinflationary growth, that Goldilocks phase, to a line that is straddling the inflation, the top right quadrant, the inflationary quadrant, and the top left quadrant, the stagflationary quadrant. And in my piece, I concluded by saying that, look, oil is really, I've always believed oil is a key input to the macroeconomy because there's so many downstream products that are consumer facing, whether it's, transportation fuel, petrochemicals. And then if you expand to the rest of the energy complex and talk about the natural gas and urea derived, products like fertilizer and then on and on downstream into food prices, there's a lot downstream that we haven't even felt yet, the inflationary side of things. And so that kind of leaves us walking this tightrope. I don't know. I still don't really know how this Iran situation is going to resolve itself. So in my book, we are straddling this tightrope in the short to medium term. The good news I see, though, is that longer term, I think this is a wake-up call to the entire world, especially to the Middle East, that there has to be a major rewiring and rerouting of oil routes in the Middle East, right? And you're seeing that happening in real time, where they are building pipelines and alternate routes around the Strait of Hormuz. So probably in 3 to 5 years, Hormuz will no longer be the choke point that it is today. But it doesn't solve the current problem, right?
Michael, I want to go back to something you were saying about the tariffs. Why would that type of inflation not necessarily be consumer facing, considering that if we have an external cost imposed on goods coming into the US, wouldn't that necessitate just passing that cost on to the consumer, to the people buying those goods?
Well, yes and no, because I think that it depends on the demand elasticity of the goods. During that period of time, I wrote a lot about how you have to really think about, like, if I were advising the Trump administration at that time, and I wrote a lot of sort of op-eds on my blog about this, I said, I would bifurcate the tariffs into sort of these critical path industries, right? Mm-hmm. Versus non-critical path industries, right? Like, I would probably relax tariffs on, you know, tchotchkes and toys and things like that, right? Because it doesn't matter to us. We want cheap toys and cheap tchotchkes. Great. Okay. But in certain critical path areas, the idea behind tariffs as a demand redirection tool in the first place is to disincentivize, you know, the purchasing of cheap substitutes from China, and incentivize, at least initially, perhaps more expensive production here, but ultimately it makes us a more geopolitically secure country. But to answer your question, so it depends on the demand elasticity of the good, whether or not it gets passed through or not, right? Because if it's a highly demand elastic good, I don't think you're going to see a lot of consumer-facing inflation. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of threats of substitutes. And so therefore, you know, when demand elasticity is high, if prices go up, right, then demand goes down. There's demand destruction. Mm-hmm. If it's a demand inelastic good, right, then it's a different matter, right? If it's an essential, then you will see prices go up. Now, here's an important point, though. What's different about the current oil-led inflation now versus, say, what we saw in 2021, which really sparked this runaway inflation that we saw in 21 and 22, is that this time, this inflation is a supply-side shock, which is also demand-destructive. Then in 2021, that was a massive fiscal goosing post-COVID. That was a demand-led inflation. It's a totally different mechanism, right? Because in the aftermath of that round of inflation, you needed the Fed, right? I go back to my vodka Red Bull dynamic, right? You had so much like fiscal Red Bull being thrown at the system. You had to balance that cocktail with a very heavy dose of monetary depressing, right? But here, it's not necessarily, well, the fiscal Red Bull, I should say, is coming from the reshoring initiatives, right? And some of that, though, is also being funded by other countries, right? So what I wrote about in the past is that as a result of this sort of reverse Marshall Plan, this reshoring stuff, these reshoring initiatives, even though we are having fiscal Red Bull into the economy, a lot of that money is also coming from outside. It's other people sort of paying our fiscal Red Bull. And we could have our cake and eat it too if it allows this disinflationary growth, right? But now we've got this inflation dynamic re-injected into the equation. The inflation dynamic now, though, is what still gives me hope that if we resolve this soon, we can fall back into that disinflationary growth, is that the secular forces that are unleashed by AI, by some of these reshoring initiatives, it tends to be a deflationary at best and maybe disinflationary, sorry, at worst, a deflationary force, and at best, maybe like a disinflationary force that kind of anchors us into this Goldilocks growth path. Mm-hmm. It's the, what I worry about is if this prolongs itself, right? And it forces the administration or forces the politicians back into a COVID-like response where, okay, the demand destructive element of high oil prices and higher downstream inflation, if that forces another juicing of the fiscal spigot to like just, you know, help out the flagging consumer, then we're going to start to deeply embed inflation expectations and get back into more like a 2021 type scenario, right? I think it might be interesting to kind of take a tour around like the different sort of macro indicators. Cause, you know, before we started talking today, what I did was I went on to, again, I'm going to plug my product, Urban Kjellberg. I have a macroeconomic dashboard with like, you know, 32 different macro tiles and split up between roughly sort of five sectors, I'll call it. Mm-hmm. There's measures of inflation, measures of labor, measures of economic growth, measures of consumer strength, and then measures of housing demand, right? So I'll give you a quick tour, right? So the idea is to kind of just give a lay of the land before and after the Iran war started. So first, inflation. If you look at CPI, PPI, PCE, CPI, PPI, and PCE, it's all pointing up, right? CPI before the Iran war, 2.4% had been trending lower, right, from the threes. And then now it's at, the latest print was 3.8%. PPI was most striking, right, before the war, 3.4. The last print was 6%. PCE before the war, 2.9, now it's like 3.8, right? So inflation measures solidly up. Labor, interestingly, has been relatively benign to getting better. Unemployment has been kind of steady, 4.4 before, 4.3 now. So a slight improvement, actually. Non-farm payrolls kind of have been going higher. We had a pretty negative print, actually, right before the war, negative 156. And then it rebounded sharply, plus 185, plus 115 initial claims. But the recent JOLTS data that just came out was also pretty strong, right? So I would say that labor, flat to improving, right? Growth, if you look at GDP growth, it's gone from like, you know, kind of 0.5 to, it's actually been accelerating, you know, post Iran war to 1.6%. And then surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, because this is part of the sort of reshoring dynamic, ISM manufacturing, 52.4 to 54, industrial production, 0.6, it kind of went down and then it went back up. And then ISM services similarly went down to go back up. So growth metrics, I would say, are also sort of inflecting higher. Okay, so we have inflation higher, labor getting better, growth going getting better. So now for the negatives. This tightrope, and the fact that we're straddling the stagflationary quadrant is really taking a toll on the consumer. If you look at the consumer, here are my metrics, right? I'm looking at retail sales going from 0.9 to 0.5. So kind of, and then it kind of went up and then went down. Personal income kind of flattish, also went up to went down, going down again. Personal spending and consumer confidence. These numbers have all been, they had been inflecting higher, but now they're inflecting lower again. Interestingly, consumer confidence, there are two measures that I look at. There's a consumer confidence that went from 91.2 to 93%, shows a slight improvement. But the University of Michigan one, which tends to get most of the MSM attention, that one's really fallen hard. It's gone from 56.6 down to 44.8. Some people say that's a very political number. I don't know, but it is what it is. It gets reported a lot. That one worries me. And then if you look at also inflation expectations, this one worries me. Before the war, I think it was around like 3.1 or 3.4%. Can't read my handwriting. Now it's up to 4.8%. So that one, so the combination of consumer confidence flagging and some of these other consumer metrics going lower with inflation expectations getting stickier, that definitely worries me. And what worries me is actually that politicians might, I hope the Trump administration doesn't do this just for the sake of trying to win the midterms, which is to kind of give handouts, right? Because that would really juice us back into the 2021 Biden era inflation. Mm-hmm. And because, right. And oh, so then the last group of measures I want to talk about are housing. And this housing's kind of mixed. You see housing starts have actually been relatively strong, surprisingly, but then you have conflicting data with building permits, existing home sales, new home sales. I would say housing is kind of mixed. So that's kind of like a quick macro lay of the land. Overall, it's not as bad as you would think, but you know, again, we touched upon this just a little bit, but there are a lot of downstream effects that are going to be consumer facing that we have not yet seen, right? We've not yet seen really food inflation pass through the system. We've not yet seen what increased petrochemical prices are going to do, right? The only real instant impact we've seen are higher fuel prices. And that's even that is somewhat muted and that's a whole other nuanced discussion that we can have, because, you know, the refining system of the world has been disrupted so much. There's been so much refining capacity that's been taken offline, either because of damage, as in the Middle East, where 3.6 million barrels of refining capacity has been taken offline for as much as 6 months, I'm told, to, you know, China's refiners also slowing down because they've banned their product exports, right? So the estimates that I've read are that, you know, China, the demand destruction, the artificial demand destruction from these refiners either being shut down or slowed down is to the tune of 6 to 7 million barrels per day of oil consumption. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason why we are not seeing maybe $150 oil, especially given like the inventory drawdowns.
Michael, again, going back, we talked about PPI versus CPI. Does PPI typically tend to lead CPI?
Sometimes. That's the concern, right? And PPI is the one that's really exploded right now. Mm-hmm. Right. But again, I think it completely goes back to the demand elasticity of the underlying goods, because you could have a situation where, PPI is up, but if it's in the sectors that are very demand elastic, the toys and the tchotchkes, let's say, I don't think you're going to see a lot of pricing power from those manufacturers, right? But if it's in staples that everybody needs to live, then that has a much bigger impact on the CPI itself, right?
And then, you know, I this is always a, let's say, a hotly contested topic, but are metrics like CPI and PPI, but let's just say specifically CPI, can we trust that data set, that data source? You know, to your point about fuel and energy costs, I did an interview yesterday and brought up the idea that, you know, the cost of gasoline is up 52%. European nat gas is up by 54%. Jet fuel is up by 58%, and WTI crude is up by 60%. So how do we try to analyze or understand CPI and consumer prices ex energy?
Ex energy?
Well, didn't they take energy out of the measure of CPI? Because like the measure of it has changed over time, right?
Or I think, I don't know, but I mean, with, you know, I'll just make a comment on energy. I think you are, it's unclear to me how much demand destruction is happening. I bet, you know, in addition to that refining effect where it's depressed the demand of oil, I think you are actively seeing demand destruction in products too. And whether it's forced or you know, certainly if you look at the sort of K-shaped economy, right? I mean, if you're like wealthy, right, and it doesn't really matter whether or not, you know, fuel prices are higher or not, it's not going to really dissuade your travel plans. What could dissuade your travel plans, or what could derail your that's the right word I was looking for, could derail your travel plans is jet fuel shortages, right? So for the most part, I was at a party last night and, you know, talking to a lot of my friends, you know, on summer vacations, and, you know, most people are going to Europe still and, you know, at least hoping. But I pointed out, I said, you know, for the first time ever, I've started buying travel insurance because I'm concerned that, you know, some of these trips could get, you know, derailed because of jet fuel shortages. You just don't know. Mm-hmm. And so that would have a big demand destructive effect. It's a really tricky situation when it comes to that. But then, you know, on the lower income scale, you're going to see a lot more, I think, staycations. This is in a way almost similar to COVID where, you know, you're going to see just people doing like staycations and local trips, you know, instead of the big international trips. Mm-hmm.
So, Michael, now that we've kind of established the landscape of what is on either side of this tightrope here, you presented these ideas to the San Francisco branch of the Federal Reserve. Tell us a little bit about that experience and not only what you saw, but what you took from it.
Yeah, it was really cool. Yeah, I was part of a roundtable of a bunch of people. The Federal Reserve, the different branches of the Federal Reserve, one of their mandates is to not just, you know, not only do they have people collating the quantitative research, but they also conduct these regular roundtables with local business leaders to get qualitative aspects, right? So I thought this was very interesting. This was my first time participating in such a roundtable, and it was also very interesting to me to learn that the LA branch of the San Francisco Fed handles most of the cash management and processing of the entire sort of Western United States, which is pretty amazing. I mean, you know, we're standing basically, you know, inside that vault area, looking at what I think was probably tens of billions of cash. I've never seen this much cash together. You know, it's pretty amazing to see how the sausage is made. I mean, you see how, you know, currency comes in from all the different, you know, I think this LA branch receives daily, you know, cash from armored trucks from like 720 different financial institutions throughout the entire Western region of the U.S., processes that cash, counts the cash, tries to find the old bills that need to be decirculated, automatically shreds those bills, detects counterfeits and flags them, and then rebundles it into new piles of distributable cash that can then go out to the banks when the banks recall their cash. So it's very much a, you know, it's kind of cool to see how that sausage is made. This, you know, the Federal Reserve is basically like, you know, the bank's bank, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is how you're seeing how they deal with it. But so that was the sort of inside baseball that we saw that was cool. And then the participating in this business roundtable was also a highlight because, you know, I think it impressed me that, you know, the Fed is actively canvassing business sentiment. And, you know, the questions revolved all around things like, you know, what are you seeing in your business with respect to demand, input costs? So there's definitely a lot of concern, right, by the line of questions that we got around input prices. And then are you able to hold the line on your prices, or are you passing them through to your consumers? So the answers that my fellow roundtable participants provided was a very varied response, right? Again, it goes back to the demand elasticity, because there's some products or some industries that were able to essentially hold the line. They don't want to lose market share, and so they pretty much held the line and it took the margin hit, and they seem to be holding the line. But there seemed to be a general consensus that, yeah, I mean, you know, if this keeps up, you know, maybe we're not going to hold the line definitely, right? So that's the part that is concerning. And then, yeah.
So Michael, do you think there's any ability to get us back to this Goldilocks zone, considering, let's say, the downstream effects of costs rising based on the reduction in supply in critical energies and other products like fertilizer?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I mean, the secular forces, the deflationary forces around AI, I think, are still quite significant, and we haven't really seen those really materialize yet either. But, you know, for the most part, when I see, I have a good friend who runs a shoe manufacturing company, and the amount of automation that he's been able to build into his supply chain is nothing short of unbelievable. I mean, from, you know, for instance, the design of a shoe, the design of a skew, to creating, you know, the actual product spec, to getting it manufactured, to then putting it into like a ad campaign. He told me that, you know, the typical process that the shoe manufacturer has to go through to get from point A to point B, right, that entire process could take like, you know, 4 to 6 months, right? With his system, I've seen it work in real time. He's literally able to do that entire thing in about 90 seconds. Now, that's like crazy. And I mean, think about how deflationary that is potentially on a whole slew of middlemen and service costs and whatnot, right? So that's also very, very hard to figure out. And ultimately, I feel like my gut just tells me that secular force that AI is giving us, that's a very, very strong deflationary force that hopefully can counter some of these more, you know, short-term supply shock-driven inflationary forces. So I hope that the two cancel out, and you still can get this sort of disinflationary growth perspective. What I'm watching for, what my antenna are sensitive to right now are, again, given elections coming up, I'm worried about any sort of goosing of like the fiscal pump to consumers, right? Because politicians will want to or feel tempted to do that, especially when you see this exacerbation of the K-shaped economy, right? And if they do that, we're going to, that's the worry. I don't want to see us get back into like a 9% inflation situation like we saw in 2021, mm-hmm. right? Absent that, what I can see happening is we're going to be in the stagflationary sort of quagmire for a bit. It's hard. It's right now, it's hard for me to see the imminent off ramp to that. I mean, to your point, higher food prices are coming down the pike. You know that, higher petrochemical prices, higher, that translates into higher plastic prices. I mean, so there's going to be some of that too. So I don't, as to what, how they can, how much of the disinflationary impetus can balance out this inflationary impetus remains to be seen. That's the hard part to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, obviously this is speculation, but what are the, let's say, the demand destruction effects if we continue to see, the Strait of Hormuz close? I know it's been also threatened that the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, which is, I think, responsible for something like 10% of energy transport versus 20% of energy transport coming through Hormuz. If that gets closed as well, does that get us to $150 oil? And what are the demand destruction factors that come into play at that level?
No, for sure. At that point, then I would actually worry about potential recession or like almost a deflationary a fallout from that, right? Because that would be highly demand destructive, I think, right? So, we just haven't seen that yet. And that is definitely on the back of my mind, right? In the back of my mind. You know, you go back to even like 2008, where everybody thinks that, rightly, that the bubble was in housing. But people also forget that the pinprick that pricked that bubble was initially $150 oil in 07,
mm-hmm.
right? So oil is just so important to the macro economy. It just can't be understated. Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, again, we have no way of knowing this, but if there is more escalation, and we've seen actually more attacks on Russia, for example, recently, it just seems like there is a never-ending road at this point to actually getting a resolution to this conflict. So, I mean, to me, these are tail risks that continue to push us, I would say, in the inflationary scenario.
Well, there is a scenario, okay, there is a scenario where, so I've heard different theories about this, right? Where geopolitically, it actually could behoove us as in the U.S. to allow this to play out, because ultimately, no matter how painful this is, it's a relative game where the U.S. is actually far better equipped to thread the needle and come out of this than, say, China or, say, Europe. Europe is actually probably in the weakest spot, right? Mm-hmm. Because their export-driven economy is being eaten by China, and then they're completely dependent on, fuel imports as well, right? Asia, the rest of the world is much more vulnerable. China has the benefit of a lot of stockpiles right now in terms of oil stockpiles, but that's not going to last forever. Right? So the U.S., where the U.S. shines here is that obviously we're a net exporter of oil. We don't have that much Middle East dependency. We have to import a little bit from the Middle East, but not much. Most of our heavy grades are coming from, basically Mexico, Canada, and now Venezuela, right? to balance out our, and then we're mainly exporting Light Suite. So we are, I've always thought that this road to sort of autarky, or, you know, sort of self-sufficiency, is achievable in North America. North America is, especially if we operate as a geopolitical bloc, the US, Canada, and Mexico, we are much, much better equipped to ride out these types of cycles. So the question is, for the rest of the world, how they're going to deal with this, because, you know, China is already taking some steps. They're banning their product exports. And it's interesting, because you might think that, okay, so by banning their product exports, they're able essentially to slow down their refining capacity. And so, like I said earlier, on the outset, or from the outside, it might look like Xi is doing Trump a favor, where he's actually keeping a lid on oil demand and keeping oil prices down. Where in fact, you could construe this the exact opposite way. By putting a lid on product exports, they're putting pressure on the most consumer-facing part of the petroleum complex, which are the distilled products. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to impact global consumers most, right? But again, you know, they're walking the tightrope too, because if they get too cute with that, right, eventually they're going to run out of their own products. Now, China's been working like mad to diversify away from the petroleum economy by electrifying their economy, by building coal plants, by building nukes, right? And so I think we need to do that too. You know, last year I wrote a piece about how I think ultimately, I think natural gas is going to be the more important hydrocarbon for us, because we between the data center build out, between the LNG export demand and this electrification of the economy, natural gas is going to be wind up becoming the bigger input cost to energy, but it's still going to take some time.
What direction do you think that the Fed can move to have any effect on any of these outcomes?
I really don't envy the incoming Fed chair, because, you know, obviously Trump wouldn't have picked him if he didn't think that, you know, Warsh is going to come in and lower rates. But I just don't think he can. I truly think that the Fed is boxed here, right? Because the you know, if again, you go back to all those metrics that I talked about, from a growth and unemployment perspective, there's really no reason for him to cut rates, because the economy so far seems to be okay. The one thing is, you know, he's probably keeping track of like the consumer metrics, you know, starting to flag, right? And so, but you can't, you know, the Fed has a very, very blunt tool. You can't like surgically go help, you know, just the consumer parts, right? So if he lowers rates, you know, that I think that will potentially stoke the inflationary fires. Now, should he hike? Well, again, no, not really, because this current setup is different than the 2021 setup, like I said, because this is a supply-driven inflationary shock, which is demand destructive in and of itself. The oil shock is already a tax hike, and it's already slamming the little guy, right? It's really slamming the consumer. So if you hike into this, right, you're also adding to the pressure on the consumer. So I think the Fed is boxed. There's no good outcome. I think, and my base case is that they're just going to kind of try to wait it out and do nothing for a while. And, you know, Trump will be pissed that he's not getting imminent rate cuts, but it's hard for me to see a good case for hikes or cuts right now.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, we thought Powell was in an unenviable position, but I think Warsh to deal with any of us on either side is going to be a very difficult position ultimately, I think.
Yeah, very difficult. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So we just need some clarity on how this resolves. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, in my piece, I talked about how, like, you know, the IRGC is like the seven headed Hydra, right? You cut off one head and another two sprout in its place. And you're not even sure if you're negotiating and coming to a deal, are they really the legitimate regime that's in charge? I mean, it's not really clear. And so that's the tricky thing about this whole dynamic. But, you know, look, capital has a way of rerouting itself and finding a way to solve this, right? So this is going to solve itself, and ultimately Iran might think that they have all the cards right now, the short term, but they're going to wind up sowing the seeds of their own destruction in terms of their leverage, I think, because by holding the world hostage now with the Strait, I think you will see these energy maps completely reroute themselves in the next couple of years.
Michael, is it possible that we get an AI-led boom that helps reduce the federal debt and, you know, bring a lot more efficiencies into the economy? And what does that do not only to inflation, but also to employment?
Oh, absolutely. So look, I think that if you go back to what I was talking about, the CBO in terms of the productivity numbers, and just put a little bit more meat on the bone. So when the CBO came out with the projections that the BBB was going to take debt to GDP from 120 to 150%, they're assuming 1.2% productivity growth, right? Which was, again, I said, that was like a trough level that they assumed. They then came out a couple months later with a mea culpa, and they said that, oh, you know what? We should just say that if productivity growth was just 50 basis points higher, say 1.7%, our 10-year projections drastically change. Instead of debt to GDP going to, you know, 150%, it could actually drop to about 100%. That's from 50 basis points. Now, can you imagine if we wind up having productivity growth of 3.5 to 5%, which is what we saw in the mid-90s during the internet boom? And, you know, the jury's out, but I think that the productivity enhancements from AI are going to be much higher than even, potentially much higher than what we saw during the internet revolution in the mid-90s. So to answer your question, I could definitely see a situation where, you know, these short-term effects notwithstanding, given this disruption in oil, I think those secular forces are far stronger. And I think those, you know, my hope is that those secular forces win out. So I definitely can see that happening.
And
then especially, by the way, especially if we can find our way to rewire our energy grid and our hydrocarbon dependence like China, right? Move away from depending on oil and moving towards depending more on natural gas and nuclear.
Mm-hmm. And on the other side of that, you know, when we look at the cash being burnt by companies like Anthropic or OpenAI, especially coupled with this rising capital cost, aka the, you know, the rising yield curve, what side does that put, like, what side of the scale does that put pressure on?
What do you mean? You want to rephrase that?
Do you mean
like the inflationary effects of their own spending, or?
Well, you know, what does that ultimately lead to, right? Like we've been talking about this, or we've been hearing about the idea of an AI bubble crash, especially when companies are burning cash as they are, and especially going into a higher rate environment. Does that not put more pressure on their ability to continue to operate and borrow in that higher rate environment?
Yeah, you would think so, right? You would think so. Meanwhile, we're about to see the largest IPO ever at one of the probably the most, the highest valuation ever. So capital markets are being very, very generous despite all of these boogeymen that we've talked about. It's pretty remarkable, right? It's so bifurcated. And then when you go back to, you know, this, the AI, I mean, there's also this AI disruption narrative, right? I created kind of like an AI disruption basket in SaaS land to look at what those stocks have done. They kind of pummeled, right? Mm-hmm. But just in my own adventures in coding my project, I realized that, you know, it's one thing to vibe code something and come up with a beautiful dashboard very quickly, but it's another thing entirely to come up with something that's commercial grade, security hardened, robust. And so there was, you know, after, I think in February, you know, that was also when like the whole SaaSpocalypse scare happened in private credit and CLOs. So with respect to the SaaSpocalypse, I've been pretty consistent saying that I think that the per seat numbers for a lot of these SaaS companies is necessarily going to go down, and they're no longer going to be able to exert almost like monopolistic, you know, pricing power in many cases. And they had, you know, they really had this gravy train that seemed like it was going to last forever, and their equity multiples showed it, right? So, you know, do those SaaS companies deserve a re-rating in their equity multiples? Yeah, I think so. I think that was well deserved. Mm. However, does it also mean that we're going to see an imminent rash of bankruptcies? I don't think so, because for a number of reasons, right? Like, you know, one of them is what I talked about, how, you know, it's you're not going to quickly see. You're seeing a ton of people come up with like little dashboards and little products and tons of startups. It's definitely creating a lot of innovation. But remember, the software companies themselves also have the benefit of these tools, and the software companies that are able to make use of the tools in their favor, especially the ones that also have data moats and proprietary data moats. You know, so I think they're Some will get disrupted for sure, but I don't think it's necessarily going to cause like a credit apocalypse anytime soon on that front. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a deflationary impact. This is definitely a deflationary impact on their pricing power.
So, Michael, how does the rubber meet the road here for you? How are you, let's say, defensively positioning yourself in order to accommodate for the tightrope that we're currently walking?
Very carefully. I don't actively trade my book that much. Mm-hmm. I tend to, you know, for the book, the part of the book that I do trade, I tend to like, you know, sort of idiosyncratic special situations that don't have a lot of beta, right? Since retiring from active fund management, oh gosh, that was already 7 years ago now. Kind of crazy. You know, I've transitioned my approach to, I outsource a lot of the money management. I invest in other managers, other funds. And I've said to you in the past that my goal is to create a very diversified stream of cash flows. Mm-hmm. I want to generate a lot of uncorrelated streams of passive income. So they are coming from sources like, you know, I do have oil and gas private equity. I recently became a general partner in this natural gas minerals fund that is meant to, you know, benefit from this transition from, you know, the oil to gas transition that I wrote about. Mm-hmm. I'm invested in a number of other multi-sleeve funds that are, for instance, funding everything in these like idiosyncratic verticals, like, you know, financing aircraft landing gear to rural car washes to just idiosyncratic little private equities. Mm-hmm. So I'm really trying to find things that are orthogonal to a lot of different themes. I mean, you know, and then with some of that cash flow, I'll put it into, you know, a couple of, you know, moonshot type bets. You know, recently made a small investment in Anduril. So I'll have some of these like AI/defense tech types of bets on, but I'm different than a lot of family offices in that I really don't have sort of like a 60-40 type of thing. I don't have like a big passive element to my book. I don't have a passive beta element because I figure like a lot of these other strategies have some inherent beta in them. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for ultimately a mix of orthogonally generated passive income, and then like I said, diverting some of that passive income into option like payoffs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, Michael, give us an overview on your project that recently took over your mind and your time here on Urban Cowbird a little bit more.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because back in March, I wrote a piece called There and Back Again, saying that, you know, this has kind of come full circle because my first job out of college I was a software designer at Goldman Sachs. I was writing the currency options software for the FX group. And then about a year into the job, I get drafted onto the trading desk serendipitously, and thus started my 35-year detour or sidetrack into finance, I like to call it. So throughout the rest of my career, right, I became a consumer of these financial tools. You know, back then on the trading, at the J. Aaron trading desk, we were using, you know, products like, you know, Reuters and technical charting tool called CQG, I remember. And then when I was in the hedge fund business at Canyon and at Acanthos on my own, primarily on Bloomberg, right? And everybody knows Bloomberg costs 30, 35 grand a year, et cetera. After I retired from active fund management in 2019, I got rid of Bloomberg. You know, I didn't need to spend that much money anymore on a terminal. I went to this product by Refinitiv called Icon, maybe like 15 grand a year. It was not a good product. Ultimately, got rid of it and settled for like a hodgepodge of different tools, you know, paying 2000 here, 2000 here, a couple different tools. And then all that changed as of like 3 months ago, because when I started playing around with Claude and I realized what I could build, I started building, you know, I started envisioning kind of like a multi-asset class tool, allows me to look at macro, allows me to look at geopolitics, allows me to look at individual equities, credit, the rates. And it kind of evolved into this Urban Cowbird project, and it's taken on a life of its own. It's a huge code base now. It's almost 200,000 lines of code, and, you know, got a couple thousand people on it on the beta. I recently kind of closed the beta to just my walled garden of Substack subscribers because I need to develop this on my own time frame. At first, I was thinking, yeah, you know, I want to try to monetize this within like 3 months, but I'm like, no, you know, I don't need the money. It's right now, it's captivating my attention from a learning standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I've infused within it a lot of my own, my ways of looking at the world, right? So I've built some cool tools in it. Like, you know, this one tool that I like called Moats, which is kind of like a Michael Porter's Five Forces analysis. It gives you a quick snapshot of the competitive dynamics of the company and its relative moat. So it's kind of a qualitative analysis, but then, you know, it also gives you this earnings module, allows you to look at, you know, DCFs, which is pretty neat. You can look at the trends in the financial statements. And then there's a goal seek feature in the DCF functionality that I built where you can hold all measures constant except for one and then goal seek the price Goal seek the DCF value to the current stock price and see what it's imputing for, say, revenue growth or operating margin and whatnot. I find that to be very powerful. And then I have this earnings feature. This earnings module is really, really rich in terms of its abilities, because you can look at earnings transcripts, you can look at the earnings reports themselves, and then analyze it. The big, big project that I am working on for the last, 6 to 8 weeks now is what I call a data epistemology project. Kind of a mouthful, but what I've realized from a lifetime of using these tools is even a terminal like Bloomberg doesn't get it right. We have so many different sectors that report their financials differently, right? Bank reports its financials differently, say, than an industrial company, than say a REIT, than a, you know, CLO equity fund, equities, right? So I am trying to work on this sort of data provenance project where, you know, I'm parsing different sectors differently and trying to better the data accuracy. So that's a project that is very, very difficult, and it's going to take some time. But that's why I like, you know, this. So for, in terms of like picking like an initial vibe coding project, this was a big one to pick. But I've learned so much from doing it. Now, another really interesting side project that I've been working on is this second brain. Have you heard of this Andrew Carpathy's second brain? Andrew Carpathy, you know, the AI scientist, the former co-founder of OpenAI, who just joined Anthropic, right? So he came out with this like second brain idea, which kind of like, it's a way of creating this sort of like a repository of your own interactions with the AI and filing it away in little memories and creating like, you know, like a persistent memory. So I've been working on that, and it's been fascinating, really, really interesting to have it point out things that I might have even forgotten about. So it's interesting. We'll see. Well, I'm seeing how I'm going to infuse my Urban Cowbird with my second brain. So definitely it's a unique product. I would urge everybody to check it out. Now I have like a temporary sort of a special offer to give people kind of like a free trial to my Substack. You have to be a paid Substack subscriber to be able to access it now, because I've closed the beta off just to have like a more focused feedback mechanism to the project.
Right. Well, all these tools don't mean anything unless they're working properly, and you know, I can absolutely appreciate the amount of work that you've put into it. As we wrap up here, Michael, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or to consider as we go forward here?
I think, look, as muddy as the situation looks, I like to think that, you know, the capital is going to find a way around this. I think the Strait of Hormuz, I think everybody, no one had on their bingo card the fact that the Strait of Hormuz was going to be closed for almost like 3 months. And ultimately, it will be for the better. But the fog of war is such that it's crazy, because I'm also a big history fan, right? And I think about, you know, Roman times where, you know, you send your scouts over the hill to kind of check out where the enemy encampment is, and you know that's the fog of war. And you would think that in today's day and age that there's no more fog of war, right? Everybody can see everything. And I actually think that in a way today's fog of war is even heavier than it was 2000 years ago, because even though everybody can see everything, everybody can also fake everything, right? And there's so much deliberate obfuscation with what you see in the tweets and social media. You know, Trump will say one thing, Iran will say another thing. You don't really, really know what's going on. And so I think the markets, the markets will ultimately tell you what's going on. But right now, the markets can also be manipulated in the short term. And I'm watching for clues because I do think that the oil market is, I'm let's put it this way. If you ask me where oil prices would be if the Strait of Hormuz were closed after 3 months, I would not expected them to be at $93. I would have expected WTI to be much, much higher. Mm-hmm. But again, I go back to this fog of war. You don't know what you don't know, and you're not quite sure. You know, there are all these geopolitical things that can happen, right? So there could be targeted export bans on certain products, certain grades of oil, for instance. You know, China's kind of doing it on the product side of things. So what we haven't seen is whether we're going to respond and do something like that. So there are all these things that to just watch out for that might come out of left field. So I guess that would be my parting comment is beware of the fog of war and look for clues and look for cookie crumbs in the various markets to kind of tell you what's really going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the markets do always seem to figure out the information that we're not able to necessarily dissect from the news, from Twitter, from whatever source it is. So it's always an interesting source. So for those that want to check out your tool, that's available at urbancowberg.com. And that, right. Of course, K-A-O, not C-O-W, right?
Right.
Your blog and all your writing is available at urbancowboy.com. K-A-O.
That's right.
A-O-B-Y.
Right. And you have to, now you have to be a paid subscriber of Urban Cowboy to actually access Urban Cowberg.
Mm-hmm. And of course, at Urban Cowboy on X. Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. That's a wrap.